It's the 50th anniversary of the free speech movement.
The officers loaded him into the back seat of the police car, but before they could drive off, students began to sit down around the police car spontaneously without any prior planning. And soon the car was surrounded by students, and the plaza was filled with students sitting down around this car. And they held the car captive for the next 33 hours. And the first student to mount the roof of the car after taking off his shoes was a philosophy student named Mario Savio.
That's Seth Rosenfeld. We talk with him about his best-selling history of the free speech movement and its surveillance by J. Edgar Hoover's FBI. It's called Subversives. Then we hear some excerpts from my April 2014 interview with Betty Metzger about her book, The Burglary, The Discovery of J. Edgar Hoover's Secret FBI. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When Mario Savio climbed on top of a police car to exhort hundreds of his fellow Berkeley students to stand up for free speech, he had no inkling that what he was starting would become a nationwide movement of campus activism. Within a couple of years, hundreds of thousands of students were massing on campuses around the country in opposition to the war in Vietnam. Student bodies were on strike demanding black and other minority studies programs, and activists were promoting a whole range of political and cultural issues. I know, I was one of those activists. When I joined SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, in 1967, I was well aware that the Berkeley Free Speech Movement was my organization's spiritual and intellectual progenitor. What I didn't know, but did suspect, was that the student movement was being spied on by the FBI. But even my suspicions pale before the reality revealed in reporter Seth Rosenfeld's book, Subversives. First published in 2012 and updated in 2013, Subversives details the massive surveillance of the Berkeley Free Speech Movement, UC faculty, and administration, and its wholesale manipulation of the truth to discredit and destroy the students' campaign for their constitutionally guaranteed right to free speech. The extent of FBI surveillance was only revealed because of Rosenfeld's tenacious 30-year fight to get FBI files released under the Freedom of Information Act, an important civil liberties fight in itself. Those files not only revealed the scope of FBI spying, but also that Ronald Reagan was a long-term FBI informant. Reagan went on to sail into the governorship of California and ultimately the White House on the ship of red-baiting the student movement. I asked Seth Rosenfeld how he came to embark on his odyssey to write Subversives and get the information he needed to do it.
Well, I first got interested in the subject of the FBI's activities at the University of California when I was a student at UC Berkeley in the 80s. And I knew Berkeley had been a center of protest during the 60s, and even before that, in the 50s and in the 40s and 50s, it had been the scene of an epic battle over the loyalty oath for professors and university employees. And of course, in the 60s, it was an epicenter of protest, including the free speech movement of 1964 and anti-war protests and later People's Park protests in 1969. And I also knew that the FBI had been involved in unlawful surveillance and harassment of citizens elsewhere. I knew this from congressional hearings that exposed that during the 1970s, the hearings led by Senator Frank Church. So I was wondering if the FBI was involved in those kinds of activities elsewhere, what was the FBI up to behind the scenes at Berkeley? So I submitted the first of my Freedom of Information Act requests in 1981, seeking any and all records on the University of California at Berkeley, and many prominent people who had been involved in events there, ranging from student activists like Mario Savio, a leader of the free speech movement, to Clark Kerr, who was president of the University of California, and all kinds of events. I thought I would get the records in about a year, that I would finish the project and then go on to the next story. But I had no idea that I was embarking on what would become a 30-year legal battle under the Freedom of Information Act, in which I would bring five lawsuits that would lead seven federal judges to order the FBI to release more than 300,000 pages of documents concerning the University of California during the Cold War, and also that the courts would order the FBI to pay my pro bono attorney's fees of more than $1 million under a provision of the Freedom of Information Act that says when requesters substantially prevail in court, the government agency must pay their legal fees. So I was just extremely curious to know what J. Edgar Hoover's FBI had been up to secretly at the nation's largest and leading public university during a time of great turbulence and unrest in the 1960s.
Berkeley was, in fact, the birthplace of the student movement, I think you can say, with the free speech movement of 1964. Although a group of students were already pressing for the right to political speech on campus before that, tell us about the incident that sparked the fire, the arrest of a student who had been manning a table with informational literature about civil rights.
Well, this was the beginning of the free speech movement, and that happened in the fall of 1964, so just 50 years ago, this coming October 1st, the anniversary of the free speech movement. And what had happened is there had been a small amount of student activism at the University of California at Berkeley in the early 60s, but it was during the summer of 1964 that a number of students went to Mississippi to work with the civil rights movement, Mississippi Freedom Summer, and to help register people to vote. And they returned to the University of California Berkeley campus that fall, only to find that the university administration had started enforcing a decades-old rule against students engaging in any kind of political activity on campus concerning off-campus affairs. So this meant that students were prohibited from handing out leaflets on campus for the civil rights movement or collecting donations for the civil rights movement, and likewise that they were prohibited from handing out flyers for Barry Goldwater for president, the Republican candidate for president that year, or collecting donations for him or any other cause. And many of the students were shocked that the university was imposing this rule, and they tried to negotiate with the administration, but the administration refused to budge. So in defiance of this rule, some students on October 1st, 1964, set up a card table in front of the main administration building at Berkeley, Sproul Hall. And they defiantly began to hand out literature for the civil rights movement. Well, no sooner had they started doing that than a campus police car rolled up right into the middle of the plaza, and two officers arrested a man behind the table. He was actually a student who had just graduated with distinction in mathematics by the name of Jack Weinberg. And he had been involved in the civil rights movement that summer. The officers loaded him into the back seat of the police car, but before they could drive off, students began to sit down around the police car spontaneously without any prior planning. And soon the car was surrounded by students, and the plaza was filled with students sitting down around this car. And they held the car captive for the next 33 hours. And the first student to mount the roof of the car after taking off his shoes was a philosophy student named Mario Savio. And he would emerge as the most prominent spokesman for the free speech movement. And for the next 3 months, the University of California at Berkeley was caught up in the free speech movement protest. This went on for that entire fall and involved, at various points, the largest student sit-in in the nation's history and huge numbers of arrests, all of this nonviolent. And eventually, the University of California Board of Regents was forced to concede that this rule against political activity on campus was a violation of the U.S. Constitution. And the regents rescinded the rule and granted students the right they had under the Constitution to basically be full-fledged citizens on campus just as they would be off campus. And this was the beginning of, in many ways, was the beginning of the student movement of the 1960s. And the free speech movement inspired many other students at campuses around the country to likewise demand their rights of free speech. And it also opened the door to the anti-war movement and later to movements for ethnic studies and women's studies. So it was really the beginning of a decade of campus protest and great social change around the country.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Seth Rosenfeld about his award-winning book, Subversives. It's about the FBI's war on student radicals at the University of California, Berkeley, and Reagan's rise to power. Clark Kerr was the president of the University of California, and he was at Berkeley. I remember him being a villain as I joined the radical student movement in 1967. But he was actually a liberal who was vilified by both sides, by the conservatives and the FBI, who hated him, and by the students. How did he get himself in such a position?
Well, Kerr was very much the man in the middle. And J. Edgar Hoover targeted him and tried to destroy his career, according to FBI records that were released to me under the Freedom of Information Act. Hoover decided that Kerr was no good because he disagreed with Kerr's campus policies. And the FBI basically mounted a concerted campaign to get Kerr removed from his job because FBI officials disagreed with his handling of student protests. And the students, on the other hand, saw Clark Kerr as their enemy because he was the president of the University of California and the highest official responsible for rules that prohibited students from engaging in political activity on campus. They saw Clark Kerr as a kind of a faceless bureaucrat, and many students were very frustrated because the University of California had many bureaucratic aspects to it, being such a large institution. Students, particularly undergraduate students, many of them found it to be an alienating experience. The campus was huge. There were long lines for registration. In those days, students were given IBM punch cards to use to register for classes. And then many of the classes were very large, and students had very little contact with the professors. Instead, were working with teaching students, teaching assistants, other students, rather than professors. So there was a fair amount of frustration at the university bureaucracy, and then very specific anger at the university because of this rule prohibiting students from engaging in any kind of political activity, whether conservative or liberal or radical, on campus. So Kerr became the enemy of the students. But at the same time, J. Edgar Hoover and other FBI officials saw Kerr as somebody who was too soft on student protesters, somebody who might even be a dangerous subversive himself. And the FBI, according to internal bureau documents, tried to get Kerr fired by leaking information about his handling of student protests to members of the Board of Regents in hopes that the regents would then use that information to fire Kerr. And even sending false reports to the White House. In 1967, Kerr was being considered to head the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, the nation's largest agency in education. And Lyndon Johnson asked for a background report on Kerr, a routine procedure. But according to FBI records, J. Edgar Hoover used that process as a pretext to sabotage Kerr by sending false allegations that he had associated with suspicious characters or people who might be communists. Now, Kerr had been a labor arbitrator for decades and had been involved in settling labor disputes between unions and corporations for many years. So, of course, he associated with all kinds of people. There was absolutely no evidence that Kerr was anything but a patriotic citizen. He had never broken any law. But nonetheless, the FBI tried to destroy his career, according to FBI records. And I should mention that this was a finding of a federal appeals court in my Freedom of Information Act lawsuit.
Yeah, and you told Clark Kerr, you got a chance to interview him, and it actually came from you, isn't that right? That this kind of attempt to destroy him, destroy his career by the FBI, you told him about that. What was his reaction?
Well, Kerr was shocked and very angry, and he said that he thought the FBI's activities were despicable. And he was especially surprised because many years earlier, he had requested his own FBI records under the Freedom of Information Act, and the FBI had told him that they didn't have any information to give him. But it was only after I brought a lawsuit that forced the FBI to release information on Clark Kerr and other university figures that the FBI released thousands of pages concerning him that revealed these unlawful efforts to damage his career and undermine him.
You mentioned before that the university had become a huge bureaucracy. There's a very famous speech that Mario Savio gave, a powerful speech about lying down on the gears of the machine. What did he mean by that?
Many students were already frustrated by university bureaucracy, and they were especially upset about this ban that prohibited them from engaging in any political activity on campus. Essentially, the rule said, well, if you're standing on the sidewalk across from the university, you have constitutional rights. But if you're standing on the other side of the street, on the university plaza, you don't have constitutional rights. And many students saw this not only as an attack on their rights as citizens, but an attack on the civil rights movement, because many of them had been involved in the civil rights movement, and this rule prohibited them from doing any kind of civil rights leafleting on campus. Many businesses in downtown Berkeley and Oakland had complained to the university about students picketing their shops, and the university had been under some pressure to rein in the students as well. So the university enforced this ban. They arrested students who violated it by handing out leaflets. The students tried to negotiate with the university to lift the ban, and the university refused. So finally, on December 2nd, 1964, the free speech movement held one of its largest rallies on Sproul Plaza. And Savio gave a speech, perhaps his most famous speech. And in the speech, he criticized the university ban in terms that portrayed the university as a machine. And I can quote part of it. There is a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious.
There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
People in Sproul Plaza said that this speech had such a powerful effect that many of them who had not thought about participating in a sit-in found themselves walking into Sproul Hall, the main administration building, and joining what became the nation's largest sit-in up to that point. More than 1,000 people sat in, and they peacefully occupied the administration building. And about 800 of them were arrested the following day and carried out. So Savio's speech was really not only a rebuttal to the university's rule against student political activity, it was a cry against bureaucracy. at the university and actually throughout society. The increasingly bureaucratic nature of our society during the Cold War era.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Seth Rosenfeld about his award-winning book, Subversives, The FBI's War on Student Radicals and Reagan's Rise to Power. As I have looked back at the history of academe, and I've taught in universities, I've seen over the decades an increasing corporatism. Reading your book, Seth Rosenfeld, reading Subversives, it occurred to me that this might have been the birthplace of that idea of kind of the corporate university, the point of which is to train people to work for corporations. Is that, am I on the right track with that?
Well, the University of California is certainly an example of a massive university system that serves corporations among many other interests. But it really goes back to the 1860s and the passage of a law called the Morrill Land Grant Act, which was passed under the administration of President Abraham Lincoln. And what this law did, the federal government gave large tracts of land to states on the condition that they use the land either to sell it or cultivate it in some way, develop it, and use the proceeds to develop public universities that would teach not only the classics, but also technical skills and science that would serve society. So the idea was to promote education across a wide range of disciplines. And the University of California was one of many land-grant colleges that developed as a result of that groundbreaking law. But the University of California had grown very quickly. It had become the nation's largest public university, and many students were especially frustrated because they found the campus, especially undergraduates, found it to be a very impersonal, huge campus, a very impersonal kind of experience, and they were unhappy about that. Kerr, in the early 60s, wrote a book called The Uses of the University, in which he talked about the knowledge industry and how knowledge and the production of new knowledge was perhaps the most powerful development at this time in our history. And it was actually a brilliant analysis of how universities function and how they serve society. He analyzed the different interest groups at universities, including students and faculty on the one hand, the administration on the other, the Board of Regents, and then outside forces such as politicians and state legislatures, and also the federal government and federal funding. And he saw all these different interest groups in a state of constant tension. And he noted that when things get out of balance, you can have what essentially amounts to a kind of a war between these interest groups. And Kerr wrote this book in the early 60s, and looking back, it seems remarkably prescient in anticipating what happened with the free speech movement, in which the students staged a protest against the university rule prohibiting political activity on campus. There was a very strong reaction from many people in the community who were angry about the student protests. And you have to remember that this is the early 60s, and people were not used to, this is one of the first student protests of the 1960s, and people were not used to that kind of activity by students. They were more accustomed to the campus complacency of the 50s. So there was a lot of anger and resentment that students at a publicly supported university would engage in these kinds of activities when they, in the opinion of many people, should be doing their homework. And there was a political reaction to the free speech movement as well. Many politicians, particularly conservative politicians, demanded that the university discipline the students more harshly. And one of these conservatives was Ronald Reagan. Reagan had been a movie actor in the 30s and 40s in Hollywood. He became the president of the Screen Actors Guild, the union of actors and actresses, and then went on to work at General Electric, where he hosted GE Theater. He became a GE spokesman. And then in 1965, he began to test the waters to run for his first public office, governor of California, in the 1966 governor's race against the incumbent, Edmund G. Brown, the father of the current governor, Jerry Brown. Now, Reagan had a secret relationship with J. Edgar Hoover's FBI that went back to the 40s in Hollywood. And it was previously known, it became known in the 1980s, that Reagan had been an informer in Hollywood during the 1940s, when Hoover was investigating suspicions that communists were trying to infiltrate the movie industry to manipulate the movies and undermine American institutions. However, at the time, Reagan, who was then president of the United States, Reagan and the FBI both said that his role was very minor as an informer. But as a result of one of my lawsuits under the Freedom of Information Act, the FBI released thousands of pages of documents, previously secret records, on Reagan during the 1940s, 50s, and 60s that showed he was much more active as an FBI informer than previously known, and that he sometimes reported his colleagues, fellow actors and actresses, as suspected communists or subversives on the scantiest of evidence. And the records also show that while he was president of the Screen Actors Guild, the FBI had wide access to records on dozens of actors and actresses, records of the union, without the actors and actresses being told about it. And in return for his help in informing on people in Hollywood, J. Edgar Hoover's FBI later did personal and political favors for Ronald Reagan, wide range of things, secret things at taxpayer expense, including keeping tabs on his daughter Maureen Reagan and her romantic life, and on his son Michael Reagan's activities. And when Reagan became governor in 1966, the FBI gave him secret intelligence reports on Clark Kerr, the president of the University of California, as well as on students and professors and liberal members of the Board of Regents. And at the first Regents meeting attended by Ronald Reagan in early 1967, Clark Kerr was fired by the Board of Regents. And according to one FBI record, which contains an interview with a member of the Board of Regents, Reagan had indicated to the board that he had certain FBI reports that raised questions about Clark Kerr. So as a result of my suing to get these documents under the Freedom of Information Act, a federal appeals court made a finding that the FBI had waged a concerted campaign to get Clark Kerr fired because FBI officials disagreed with his handling of campus protests and his campus policies. And as part of this campaign, the FBI had secretly given FBI reports to its allies on the Board of Regents and engaged in other kinds of activities.
Yeah, you talk about them giving reports and also talk about, you said something before about how the public was against the students and just wanted them to do their homework. But in your book, Seth Rosenfeld, in Subversives, you show how the FBI actually manipulated public opinion, manipulated the Board of Regents and others, not just with information, but actually with lies about people. That is, they made things up. How did the FBI operate on the Berkeley campus, and what were the ways in which they manipulated information to change public opinion?
Well, in the course of doing the research for my book, I brought five lawsuits under the Freedom of Information Act. And as a result of these lawsuits, the federal courts ordered the FBI to release more than 300,000 pages of documents concerning the University of California during the Cold War. And these documents show that the FBI was deeply involved in spying on campus activities and gathering intelligence on campus about student activism, about political activities by professors, and about campus policies. And moreover, that the FBI went beyond just collecting information to using that information in an effort to harass and undermine members of the university community because FBI officials disagreed with their political views. And the courts made a finding that the FBI had a legitimate interest in gathering intelligence on protests up to a certain point. But after the FBI determined that the free speech movement, for example, was not a communist plot, but was in fact a student protest against a campus rule, and therefore there was no national security threat, that at that point the FBI's continued surveillance and harassment was not a legitimate law enforcement purpose. And on that basis, the courts ordered the FBI to release more information about those improper activities. And those activities included things such as FBI agents posing as reporters at press conferences and asking Mario Savio, free speech movement leader, questions that were intended to embarrass him and to discredit the free speech movement and generate negative news articles. The FBI also fed information to reporters who had close relationships with the FBI with the goal that they would write stories claiming that the free speech movement was really part of a communist plot to disrupt the nation's campuses. In particular, the FBI leaked information to a reporter at the San Francisco Examiner named Ed Montgomery, who has since passed away. And Montgomery wrote a front page series claiming that the free speech movement was riddled with socialists and communists, and it was really not anything other than a plot to disrupt the nation's campuses. The FBI also developed informants within the campus community, not only amongst students, activists, but professors, administrators, and even members of the Board of Regents, and gathered that information and used it for the purposes of disrupting and harassing people like the president of the university, Clark Kerr, as well as Mario Savio. Savio was one of the people that the FBI put on a list of persons it deemed potentially dangerous during a national emergency, who would be arrested without warrant and detained indefinitely in violation of their constitutional rights. So the FBI engaged in a wide range of activities that went beyond just gathering information to harassing people with whom it disagreed about public policy.
Now, there was the Church Committee in the 1970s that revealed the existence of the COINTEL program, spying on student movement, the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement. This was part of the COINTELPRO movement, and as a result of that, put some controls on this. And yet, we know, because of Edward Snowden and others, that the mass surveillance of U.S. citizens started up again after 9/11, and in fact is greater even than before. Could you draw some parallels to what's going on today, and has there been any progress, or has all the progress been undone?
Well, there's some very interesting parallels between what happened during the 1950s and 60s and what's happening more recently after 9/11 in regards to the balance between national security on the one hand and civil liberties on the other hand. What the FBI documents show is that during and after World War II, the FBI focused on the University of California because it had received intelligence that Soviet agents were attempting to steal secrets from the radiation laboratories overseen by the university. The University of California played a key role in developing the atomic bomb that was used to end World War II, and there was a very real threat posed by Soviet agents who were trying to steal these secrets. So the FBI had an important mission in investigating these allegations and protecting America against Soviet espionage. But what the FBI documents is that in the years after World War II, the FBI shifted from focusing on Soviet espionage agents to focusing on students, professors, and administrators who it viewed as having subversive ideas, who it viewed as too liberal or perhaps radical, people who were not breaking the law, who had no connections to the Soviet Union in any way, but who simply had ideas about public policy or criticisms of government policy and were deemed as a result of that to be suspicious or subversive. So what these documents show is that the FBI under J. Edgar Hoover operated with great secrecy and great power and very little oversight. And under these conditions, the FBI engaged in unlawful surveillance, what was later found by Congress and the courts to be unlawful surveillance and harassment of people, that the FBI mounted operations such as COINTELPRO, which is an acronym for Counterintelligence Program. COINTELPRO took techniques that were developed for use against wartime adversaries, different intelligence techniques and counterintelligence techniques, and applied them to American citizens who were engaged in lawful dissent against government policy. That was the finding of Congress, what was known as the Church Committee, led by Senator Frank Church during the 1970s. So there's a very interesting parallel to current events, because once again, the nation faces potentially grave threats from foreign adversaries. And there's a very real national security mission for the FBI and the National Security Agency in protecting America. But once again, these agencies are operating with incredible secrecy and power, which is an inherently dangerous, potentially dangerous combination, because it's under those circumstances that there's the greatest potential for abuse of powers. And what we've seen with the disclosures of Edward Snowden is that agencies were, the NSA and other agencies were much more deeply involved in surveillance of Americans than was previously known. And in many cases, had violated the rules laws that were intended to limit that kind of surveillance. What we still don't know is how the NSA and how the FBI and CIA have used information gathered by the NSA, how all this incredible amount of information has actually been used by federal agencies. So the Snowden revelations told us much about what the NSA was collecting, but have not told us that much about how that information is being used. And Congress, unfortunately, has so far not held hearings that examine the use of that information. And many people think that Congress should hold hearings like the hearings held during the 1970s under Senator Frank Church to investigate more thoroughly how intelligence agencies are using information and how that is affecting the rights and the lives of Americans. I think what my book offers ultimately is a cautionary tale about the dangers inherent in great secrecy and power being concentrated in intelligence agencies. And this is a constant issue, because intelligence agencies are necessary for our country, and they depend on great secrecy and power to operate. However, that secrecy and power inherently contains the potential dangers of abuse. And as we've seen in my book, Subversives, and in all the FBI records that were released under the Freedom of Information Act, we've seen how that power and secrecy can be abused. So I think the bottom line is that it's really incumbent on Americans, and particularly on Congress, to fulfill the oversight functions and to ensure that this power is not being misused as it was during the 1960s at the University of California, at Berkeley, and many other places, so that agencies are not trying to get university presidents fired because they disagree with their policies and aren't harassing student activists who are engaged in legitimate protest against government policy. because ultimately what defines America is our constitutional rights to engage in free speech and free association.
Well, it's a terrific book, Subversives, by my guest Seth Rosenfeld. Thank you so much for joining us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
Seth Rosenfeld is a freelance journalist based in San Francisco. Subversives has won multiple awards and is a bestseller. Next up, we revisit parts of my April interview with Betty Metzger about her book, The Burglary. Stay tuned.
What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that Washington never told a lie. I learned that soldiers seldom die. I learned that everybody's free. That's what the teacher said to me. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school. What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that policemen are my friends. I learned that justice never ends. I learned that murderers die for the crimes, even if we make a mistake sometime. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school. What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine?
What did you learn in school today? Sung by Pete Seeger in 1964. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. On the night of March 8, 1971, eight people carried out one of the most powerful acts of nonviolent resistance in American history. They broke into an FBI office in Media, Pennsylvania, and stole every file in the room. All were nonviolent anti-war activists, and they were convinced that the FBI was spying on Americans in order to suppress dissent. The burglars found the evidence to back that up in the files they stole. They gave the files to several reporters and two senators. One of the reporters was Betty Metzger. Then working at the Washington Post, she was the first to break the explosive story of how FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover had, for nearly 50 years, been subverting democracy and breaking the law to squash dissent. We spoke to Betty Metzger in April of this year. We now replay some of those excerpts from that interview to round out our show today, featuring the FBI and mass surveillance of the student movement of the 60s and 70s. You call this burglary, it was at the FBI offices in Media, Pennsylvania, by a group of anti-war nonviolent resistors. You call it a historic act of resistance. In fact, you say it's perhaps the most powerful single act of nonviolent resistance in American history. I mean, that's a big claim. Why do you say that?
I say that because it made Americans aware of the truth about one of its most powerful institutions, ultimately resulting in reform of not only the FBI, but all intelligence agencies, because the revelations that came out eventually led to both houses of Congress deciding that they must investigate all intelligence agencies. And until that time, this is something that wasn't even talked about. I mean, they caused the first discourse on the role of intelligence agencies in a democratic society to take place. Until then, it wasn't something people even thought about, and it would have been regarded as inappropriate that you let those institutions do what they want to do. They know best, until people found out as a result of the Median files.
Now, tell us who the burglars were. They were part of a nonviolent Catholic left, very involved with the peace movement, but not all of them were Catholic. Give us the broad view, and then I'm going to ask you about Davidin and about Bonnie and John Raines.
Well, that's right. They were involved in the peace movement, had finally, most recently, become deeply involved with people in the Catholic peace movement, although only one of the media burglars was a Catholic. There were eight of them. Keith Forsyth and Bob Williamson were both very young at the time. They had both dropped out of college specifically to in order to spend as much time as possible protesting the war. It's hard for people today to realize that that kind of thing happened, I suppose. But there were many young people who felt so strongly about the war that they decided to almost make it an occupation to work against the war. Keith was from a small town in Ohio, had been a student at Worcester College, and came to Philadelphia because he heard that the Quakers were there and there was a vast peace movement, and he worked as a part-time cab driver. Bob Williamson was from a small town in New Jersey, gone to a Jesuit school. He was the Catholic in the group, St. Joseph's in Philadelphia. And at the time of the burglary, was working part-time as a social worker for the state of Pennsylvania. There were eight altogether. I eventually found seven of them, and five of them agreed to be identified, but the other two also told their stories to me. They just didn't want to be identified, and I called them Ron Durst and Susan Smith. Ron Durst was in his mid-20s at the time, a graduate student preparing for a health profession. His motivation for the burglary, I should say the youngest members of the group, their motivation was simply from the war itself because they had no experience with the civil rights movement. But for Ron Durst, his parents were Holocaust survivors, and he had grown up hearing countless stories about his relatives who were killed during the Holocaust, people he would never meet. And he was infused with the idea of never again. And then as a young man in his 20s and he became involved in the anti-war movement, he applied that also to Cambodian people, Vietnamese people, and that never again must there be such a conflagration where so many people would die. And Susan Smith was a college professor in the Philadelphia area, now retired. She had a very traumatic experience after the burglary. She was one of the four people who went in through the FBI office that night and in the dark filled suitcases with files. And shortly afterwards, probably not much more than 24 hours later, became obsessed with the question of whether or not she had removed her glove during the burglary. And she could never be sure. She would walk through everything she had done, and she would think she had, no, she had not removed her glove. And then she would think, oh, no, I did. And she lived with that for at least a couple years, just almost on a nightly basis, being afraid that she had removed her glove and therefore left fingerprints. As it turned out, none of them had removed gloves, and there were no fingerprints, but she had no way of knowing that. And then John and Bonnie Raines, the people you said that you would ask me about. John and Bonnie Raines were a couple, and they both participated in the burglary, and at the time they had three children under the age of eight. Even at that extreme time, when many people were engaging in resistance, it still was a very unusual thing for a couple to do such a thing together. They did it because they had developed what was a fairly unusual commitment, and that was that in the case of great injustice, they wanted to be willing for both of them to fight that injustice through whatever effective nonviolent means might come along. And they thought this was such a time and incident. And they had this very strong belief that because parents sort of took a pass on the basis that because they were parents, they couldn't participate in a very deep way in political activity. They thought that because so many parents did that, a rather large number of the population was not participating in such struggles at any given time. And they thought that that was a cop-out. And they made arrangements for their children to be raised by John's brother in the event that they were arrested and went to prison for many years.
And it's a remarkable story. You haven't told us yet about Davidon, who actually was the one who hatched the plot.
That's right. This never would have happened without the insights and great ability to plan of the leader of the group, William Davidon. Bill was a physics professor at Haverford College, and he was involved in many aspects of the peace movement in Philadelphia. But by 1969, he was looking for more aggressive ways to protest nonviolently, and he was very concerned about the futility that people were feeling. And he found hope with the Catholics because they also were looking for more aggressive nonviolent means and were raiding draft boards in poor communities in the hope of actually making it more difficult for those draft boards to operate. And then in 1970, he started hearing more and more people in the peace movement talking about there being spies in their midst. And he didn't believe it. And he thought that people were just so disappointed from the war continuing that they had lost their focus and they were imagining this. But then he kept hearing it, and he also saw what a poisonous atmosphere was developing and that some people were dropping out of the peace movement because of their concern about informers. And by early fall of 1970, he really believed it was true. And he thought, this is a problem that must be solved. I mean, it was the kind of problem most people would think was too big. Who can force the FBI to reveal whether or not it's suppressing dissent? But he decided that there were, in essence, two wars going on in the United States at that time, the war in Vietnam and the war against dissent at home. And he just thought it was as important to stop the war in dissent as it was to stop the war in Vietnam. And that's when he finally decided the only way that this can be done is by breaking into an FBI office. And the reason for that was he just thought that if the American people were presented with documentary evidence, even though they idolized Hoover, that this would make them realize that something was wrong. They wouldn't want dissent to be suppressed. But he thought that the evidence was necessary and that there was no way that you could get that except by breaking in.
The media Pennsylvania burglary led to the eventual discovery of the secret FBI program COINTELPRO. I asked Metzger about the importance of that program.
Yes, that is very important. If I may add something else, just among the files that is found in the media office also, and this was not COINTELPRO, but it was huge, was the blanket surveillance that was taking place in black communities all over the United States. And I don't think that Americans today really understand or know that that kind of thing happened, that there was a policy that every FBI was supposed to have an informer who reported to him regularly on what black people were doing. And in Washington, D.C., throughout the 1960s and into the 1970s, every agent had to have six. And in the files, it actually described where this surveillance was supposed to take place. And it was simply every place that a person could be expected to go in their normal activities, like the corner store, their church, their library, their bars, restaurants, classrooms, it just anywhere. And no other part of the population, I think, had experienced blanket surveillance the way black people did. You mentioned COINTELPRO was very important. It was exposed as a result of the media burglary, although those of us who received the file on which the term was used didn't know what it was. It was a mere label on a cover sheet. And a little more than a year later, another reporter, Carl Stern at NBC, saw it and thought, what a strange thing, especially the instructions at the bottom that then instructed FBI agents to distribute the file, an article about how college administrators should control people who were protesting against the war, to give it to friendly college presidents and to write anonymous letters and mail it to college administrators who were not friendly to the FBI. And he thought that's such a strange thing for the FBI to be doing. And thanks to Carl's persistence and curiosity, by the end of 1973, we had the first information about what COINTELPRO was. And it was probably Hoover's meanest and worst operations. They were dirty tricks that were meant to neutralize and destroy individuals and organizations. And they were neither law enforcement nor intelligence gathering, nor did they lead to the prevention of crime. They were secret harassment, dirty tricks carried out by the FBI against his perceived enemies. And I suppose one of the best known ones to the public is the secret attempt to try to convince Martin Luther King to commit suicide.
We haven't yet talked about your receiving these files. You were one of the first to receive them, probably because of your work covering the anti-war movement in Pennsylvania. What was your reaction when you first got them?
Oh, you're right. I was the first to receive and the first to write. Five people received them simultaneously, three journalists and two members of Congress, and everybody else gave the documents back to the FBI. And that's partly explained by the fact that this was an unusual time, including in journalism, because it's 3 months before the Pentagon Papers. So this was the first time that a journalist had ever received secret government files that had been given to them by sources outside the government who had stolen the files. So it posed a particular ethical, legal concern with Catherine Graham, the publisher of the paper. My first reaction when I received him, I was surprised. This was 2 weeks after the burglary. There had been very little reporting on the burglary, so most of us, few people, were paying any attention to the fact that an FBI office had been burglarized. And the first document I saw was the one that said was an instruction to agents to behave in such a way that they would, quote, enhance the paranoia and make people think that there's an FBI agent behind every mailbox. And that certainly attracted my attention. It seemed quite striking that such a goal or philosophy would be reduced to writing and placed in a file, so much so that it almost seemed like it might be a hoax. But as I read on and I read about college campuses nearby, in the Philadelphia area, and black activists whose names were familiar to me when I was a reporter, I realized that they probably were real. And of course, the FBI wanted to keep us from publishing them. And so they quickly confirmed that they were authentic and then spent the rest of the day trying to prevent their publication with the Attorney General, John Mitchell, who would later serve time in prison in connection with Watergate. On that day, the day I received those files, he spent a lot of time trying to convince the Washington Post not to publish any story about them. He claimed that they would endanger national security and lives, but we could tell from what we had in our hands that that was not true. So Catherine Graham didn't want to publish, and the company counsel also recommended against publication. But two editors, Ben Bradley and Ben Bagdikian, very much believed that this was important information for the public to know about its most powerful law enforcement agency, and did convince her by the end of the day. And by 10 o'clock that night, she made a decision to publish, and it was on the front page the next day.
Betty Metzger, in an edited excerpt from our April 2014 interview with her about her book, The Burglary. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at writersvoice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.